Good morning and welcome. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy. I'm here with Darren. Darren, hi.
Hi, hi, Jerry. Even I'm Darren.
Jerry.
I'm Darren. You're Jerry.
You can call me Jerry. So this is the jumpstart for XAML. This is corollary to Essentials of Developing Windows Store Apps Using C# and XAML. Darren, you take over.
This is, where do we get to? The Essentials of Developing Windows Store Apps Using C#. This is Jerry Nixon. Meet him. He's from Colorado. He's a developer evangelist.
I am from Colorado, and I am a developer evangelist. Work for Microsoft, focus on Windows Phone and Windows 8. And today, talking about Windows 8 is a perfect opportunity to stretch my muscles here and talk about things that I really have a passion for. Darren, tell me a little bit about Crank 211.
Crank 211, we're a company that specializes in designing and building next-level digital experiences. We build for the Windows 8, Windows Phone 8 platform, as well as other platforms. And yeah, really excited today to come along and share some knowledge around XAML and C#.
You're so generous just saying other platforms like that.
I am.
Too much. So this is a corollary to the course 70838, a five-day course. And that course, of course...
Of course.
If you ask a horse, takes 5 days to complete. We will be completing it today in one. So we will. I don't think we have taken any of the content out, have we?
No, we will be speaking at light speed.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, so let's talk about what we will talk about today, and you guys can settle in, figure out the schedule. If you want to take a long lunch, if you want to drop out of a few modules or watch them all, that's up to you. And so it goes like this. The first half of the day will really be the an introduction to some of the features of Windows 8. Some of the philosophies around the UI design that developers have to consider, some of the changes in the framework that developers have to keep in mind, as well as some of the absolute basics of XAML. Basics of XAML.
There. Absolutely. We're going to do our best to not be deaf by PowerPoint. We're going to be jumping into Visual Studio. We're going to be showing you some code. We're going to be working that way. But that's the first half of the morning. The second half, we're going to be diving into resources, styles and templates. We're going to be showing how to design and implement navigation within the Windows Store app. Then we're going to look at contracts, tiles, and user notifications, so how to really exploit the features of the platform and incorporate those into your application. Then the final hour, we're going to be looking at local data, interaction with those, and planning and pushing your application out to the store.
So a couple things to keep in mind is not just that this is really one day, right, instead of the five. So it will be abbreviated. But another thing is we're going to be going through some of the features that you're seeing already in top-tier apps in the Windows 8 platform. And so things that you're going to want to implement, features that are really just standard features now in excellent applications that are delivered through the platform. However, this is just one of two courses that Darren and I are doing. Today is the first of the two, and the second one is more advanced, wouldn't you say, Darren?
I would say that, but we are actually doing three, aren't we? We've already done the C# foundation, which really builds up and leads to this, but we do have two XAML Windows 8.
Yeah, I suppose if you see them as a family, we're in the middle. This is this would be this one.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, perfect. The first one was really a focus on C#, the language structures.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're focused specifically on XAML. So basics of XAML today, advanced XAML tomorrow. But it's not tomorrow, it's in a handful of weeks.
That's basically it.
Excellent.
Setting expectations, you know, it would be useful if you've covered the fundamentals of C# and you have some idea around how to leverage C# to solve problems. We won't be focusing expressly on C# and going into any syntax elements associated with C# itself. We'll be talking more about leveraging it as part of building XAML applications for the Windows 8 platform.
As far as expectations, Darren, let's say I have a developer and he has never seen XAML. What's his experience going to be for today? What's his experience?
So for somebody who's never seen XAML, this is going to be the right session for you because we're going to be introducing those basic concepts. We're going to show you how to express yourself using XAML, what you would use XAML for, and then how to start building out some basic user interfaces using the XAML syntax.
If you're that developer, let's just say you're cranked to zero right now, right? Let's say you're all the way back. This might be a little overwhelming because we're going to be covering it so quickly.
Yes.
At the same time, if you're cranked to 11, let's say you're one of those developers that you've done XAML your entire career. There's not a syntax you don't know. this course may not be exciting for you because we're going to be covering really an intermediate level to be able to bring developers up to a level playing field so we can really start to see opportunities for developers putting excellent applications on the into the platform.
But if you are one of those, then the session that we're going to be doing in a couple of weeks' time will be for you. We'll be going in deep into the more advanced capabilities of the platform and XAML and C# and so on, and so that will be much more relevant.
It's nice we have 2 days, but even 2 days isn't enough.
Yeah, we're just scratching the surface in reality. Jerry was kind of joking earlier on saying we didn't miss out a single thing. Obviously, we've had to. We're trying to hit the high points that are very relevant for the certification and to get you those foundations of how to build these applications.
Yep, that's exactly right. We get a lot of comments during our courses that we talk really quickly. I think people don't realize how much we have a passion of putting the information into these courses. Also, the fact that we get paid by the word.
Yep.
So that helps.
So bloviation really helps.
There it is. Okay, well, let's get started. Did we miss anything?
Oh, we have a voucher that's available for your certifications, so you can get some MVA points. We'd be remiss not to mention the Microsoft Virtual Academy and the fact that they're providing this training capability. There's a lot of other products and training courses that are out there for many of the other Microsoft technologies, so make sure you take advantage of this. And we also have these code samples are uploaded on xaml.coblex.com. So
that's right.
Yeah,
so
we'll
be going through a lot of different demos. Some we'll be building from scratch. Obviously, you'll just need to watch along with us. But some of them we've built ahead of time. They're all up there at xaml.codeplex.com. You can download and kind of work through those with us. It'll be good.
Sounds great.
A lot of great code up there.
Shall we dive in?
Let's do it. Let's switch over to my deck, if you don't mind, Barry.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah?
Barry.
Call out to Barry. All right. So let's talk about the platform itself. So here's this is module one, right? So we'll be talking about three core things here. We'll be talking about one thing. We'll be talking about the platform itself. All these other things are just sub points inside it. Windows 8 introduces a lot of things that developers have never had to consider before. Especially if you're a core Microsoft developer and that's been your career path. If you're a student, these are some of the things that you get to really put into a strategic direction for you to be able to build excellent applications as well. So let's move into that. Here's the platform itself. Windows 8, of course, is just an upgrade to Windows 7. The best way to think about Windows 8, though, is that it's a reimagined version of Windows. And so the core piece there is the user experience has changed significantly. And if you are a developer, the things that you get to consider are also dramatically different as well. Well, let's just go into that so we can talk about, when you think about Windows reimagined, the core piece there is, that's a marketing term, but developer, it really does impact developers. Let's talk about what we get to think about. If you're a desktop developer today, building Windows 8 applications and building Windows 7 applications, there's a similarity, but they are not the same, right? If you've built desktop applications in Windows 7, they'll run identically in Windows 8. That's because the desktop itself, for the most part, hasn't changed. But there is the start screen that is now full screen, a full screen start screen that acts as an execution shell that allows you now to run applications inside that full screen environment. That's what we're going to be talking about. So from this point forward, whenever we say Windows 8 apps or whenever we say Windows Store apps, what we mean are the applications that run inside that new execution environment. That new execution environment gives you cross-architecture support, which means I can run on various chipsets. Basically, whatever Windows runs on, now I can run on. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be that you had to compile for each. It used to be that you may only be able to support one because of the compiler that you have. Now that all has changed. Okay, so there we are. Everything that runs on Windows 7 runs on Windows 8.
Perfect.
So the first assumption, and it's neat, you and I both have our Surfaces here, and the first assumption around Windows 8 is not that it is a touch environment. It is that it could be a touch environment. I think that's very important. When you look at the full screen execution environment, that's full screen start menu, what we're looking at really is something that could be resting in the hands of a developer or a user sitting on the couch. They're using your application. This screen really shows kind of a heat map of how the user's thumbs really reach the right and the bottom, the left and the bottom the most easily. So we'll see some of these kind of UI decisions that were made They're all going to be based on this level of information that says the user is likely holding it in their hands. Now, if they're holding it in their hands, what would make it the most easy to implement? What would make it the most easy to access? And so you'll see a lot of the UI pieces on the left, the right, and the bottom because of it. But at the same time, I think it's important to point out that the keyboard, you know, is certainly 99% of all Windows installs still.
Absolutely. Keyboard, mouse, you know, everything you can do in the operating system through touch, you can replicate through keyboard shortcuts, through the mouse, and so on and so forth. So don't feel that it's constrained. Don't feel that it's just purely targeting a tablet experience, not in the slightest.
Because Windows is doing that, targeting all three, touch, mouse, and keyboard, it's important that your app do the same thing. Certainly don't write an application that only is for touch, because you'll be losing a gigantic portion of your potential market. And don't do the opposite either. Don't forget about touch. You may not have a touch device to test on, but that's the reason we have a simulator, so that we can do that as well. So don't. We didn't miss it for Windows. You don't miss it for your app as well.
Exactly. Reach just makes sense. You know, you don't want to limit your audience. If you're going to go through the time and effort to build something to put it into the App Store, you might want to make sure that it's as relevant to as wide an audience as possible.
So take a look at some of these. These are the touch actions that we have. So we had to invent a few just to get Windows to work. There are a lot that people already know. Of course, we know how to tap something with our finger. We know how to pinch zoom. We know how to do a lot of different things. But we had to invent some things like swipe in from the side and be able to select. If I were at my start menu, for example, and I were to tap on an item in my start menu, that's going to launch it. But how do I select it? You know, do I press and hold? Well, no, because that is more information. So we had to invent all these other pieces. These are pretty much the core gestures, the touch gestures that we have. And I think the thing to take away is we will be teaching users how to use this in Windows 8. We will be introducing these gestures to users. You don't need to. In fact, there's probably another, probably more important subtext here is don't invent more, right? The idea that we had to invent more gestures is a painful thing. It's going to cost plenty of money in marketing to get users familiar with how to use these gestures. If you introduce yet another, it's just a bad strategy to not leverage what's already at their disposal.
You want to make sure that you've got this consistent vocabulary so that anybody can pick up an application and know how to start using it. You know, as Jerry says, you know, the investment's been made, the education's been there, somebody's running the platform. Don't put another block into the adoption of your application by making up new things.
So the start menu now, you could get to that from the start button. Of course, the start button has been relocated now into the charms bar. The charms bar is now on the right. You can see that, and that start menu is right there in the middle. And so the start menu is how we launch it, but above and below the start button are really what we want to talk about next. This charms is the single point of invocation for most of the UI interaction on the operating system, and it's also the single point of interaction for some of the core tasks inside your application. So let's kind of talk through those. We know that we have the start menu, the start button, that's going to launch the start menu. But we also have the search button. And we're going to talk about all these different pieces in far more detail in later sessions. But I want to make sure we at least get an overview of all of them here today. So the first is the search charm. The search charm allows me to search for anything inside my computer, right? This is, if you've used Windows 7, which I know at least more than 600 million people have, right? That you're already used to hitting the start button and starting to type, and you immediately search for all the applications and files and settings in your system. That's what this accomplishes for Windows 8, but it also allows you to search into applications, and that's really special. If I have a CRM system installed, and I wonder how to search CRM, I can do it from here. Right? Yep. There's a lot
it's
of
consistent.
Power.
Everyone is doing it the same way. Again, you don't have to train people how to use your application. If they know how to use Windows 8, they know how to use your app.
That's right. In fact, that's an important piece, is this is now going to be the core way to search, right? And so you may have advanced search, and we'll talk about how to implement some of those later. But this is, if somebody needs to search the data inside your application, this is how. So if you need to teach a user how to search, tell them to use the charms. Share is next, and we'll talk about lifecycle management later, but one of the core pieces we'll take out of it is applications are in a sandbox, and that sandbox means you can't talk to other applications. You can't do a lot of things that might ruin a machine, and that's important. But sometimes it's just important, Darren, that one app be able to talk to another. You may have two apps that do relate. They do have some sort of payload they need to share between. The share charm allows you to do that. From the user's point of view, share allows me to pass information. And so it's really nice. So if I'm inside, say, Internet Explorer, and I want to share a website, I can swipe open the charm, select share, and I can share what, and I can select whatever application wants to receive it.
And that's really powerful, because what it does is it stops you having to reinvent the wheel in every application that you write. You know, we're building very socially connected applications these days. We don't need to keep reinventing how we integrate to Facebook, how we integrate to Twitter, how we integrate to email. If we have this contracts mechanism and we have these other applications that publish, they service these contracts, your application can just say, hey, I want to share something, and leave it up to the other implementers of the contract to work out how to get it to the destinations.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I think we refer to this as lightweight communication between apps, but I think what's important to understand is it's not direct communication. This is brokered communication that allows the operating system is going to be in the middle doing all the brokering. So Windows 8, and we'll say this a time or two, at least in spirit, if nothing else, and that is that the user is king here. Windows 8, one of the biggest philosophies around it is not just ease of where your thumbs may be, but also the experience for the user in the performance of their machine, in the performance of their battery, and in the expectation of the user experience. I mean, those things are really important to us. They're really important fundamentally to Windows 8. And a lot of these decisions, a lot of these architectural things that we get to talk about are really a reflection of how can we make the user experience better, how can we make the overall device experience better as well. And so when I say that two applications can't talk to each other, that seems like an extra step, but what it really is an advocation of the user's experience. So when I say that the operating system is the broker, that means that one application can't wreck another application.
Exactly. Security and safety is one of the key aspects around these contracts, in that it provides that level of isolation. We talk about running in a sandbox. Often, people's developers' initial thought around that is, oh, good grief, how am I going to do this, that, and the other? What we're going to talk about today and in the following session is the richness of the API that's there to support this and to make you realize that you're actually not constrained. You're protected, the user is protected from the malicious application developers that unfortunately sometimes sit out there, and it preserves that experience.
I know you know this, I do too. There are some things you just can't do.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
A developer experience, or a desktop developer, you know, they're... their expectation is to have the same kind of, openness and freedom that the desktop has.
Yep.
And when you're on the desktop, I mean, if I download a desktop application, in a matter of milliseconds, it can wreck my machine, right? I mean, that's because the
Running
developer...
Running with full privilege? Absolutely.
The developer has freedom to do almost anything. A Windows 8 application, a Windows Store app, that's a different experience altogether.
It's different experience in a number of ways. In terms of presentation, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit later on, but in general, by default, they're going to occupy the full screen. You know, you have options to mix additional applications into that with docking and so on and so forth. However, if you're used to building a Windows application, a desktop application, you know, where you have multiple windows that could be overlapping and so on and so forth, that's not replicated in this environment. So there's those kind of constraints are put in place. Mm-hmm. So that, to a certain extent, also requires you to unlearn a certain number of assumptions that you have in how you build these applications, which is, again, why we're stressing this foundation.
Yeah. Again, a lot of these constraints that developers run into actually can be worked around, and it's just going to be effort to be able to not use maybe what's in your toolbox today, because some of those pieces are the ones that put the user at risk in a lot of ways.
And the benefits that you get from some of these constraints, however, is you're not writing installers anymore. You're not writing all of the system-level integration that we used to have to write with those rich applications, and we're not having to put our own security checks in place to ensure people aren't accessing areas that they shouldn't be accessing. Yeah. The framework provides that for us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Back to share for a second. I mean, if I have an application and I'm about to share some information out, the operating system lists everything that I could share to, and what's neat is it lists everything. I may not even know what the user has installed. In fact, what they have installed may not have even existed when I wrote my application.
Absolutely.
Let's say it was with the XYZ app that they're going to share to. I wrote this 6 months ago when the XYZ app didn't exist.
Yeah.
Now suddenly I support the XYZ app. I didn't even know it.
That's the wonderful thing. I mean, there is that discoverability aspect of your experience in Windows 8, you know, from a user's perspective. And as you state, you know, if the new grand wave of some social experience suddenly bursts onto the scene, anybody who's already implemented that share contract will gain access to that just by virtue of the fact that this new social wave has incorporated the share contract.
Yeah. There's a lot here. I can already feel it, right? We're really rolling.
Exactly. Go.
Okay, so the third charm. So out of the four charms, the third charm is the devices charm. And devices is special. And what it actually is showing, it's showing a lot of different things. It's showing things that register themselves as devices on your machine so that I can share directly to something that's, say, like a printer or maybe something that acts like a printer. So like OneNote will act like a printer. But what it really does, and one of the things that really is feature-rich here inside Windows 8, just gives it to an application developer, is it shows DLNA devices on my home network. So I say home network, it may be my local network at my company. It might be because I'm at home. And I can see DLNA is that standard that allows me to talk to a media device, say like a television or, or speakers or a receiver, and then I can pass to that media information. So I can pass sound, I can pass images, I can pass video, and then use my device as a controller for that. So let's say I write an application that shows the dancing cat.
Which you've had many of them.
I did, and they don't sell as fast as I think.
I can't imagine
expectations,
why.
Yeah. And but let's say I've got the dancing cat, and I want to share that with all the people that are sitting in the room. I have a a television over there that's DLNA compliant. I swipe from the right. I see my devices. There's my television. I say share. Automatically, then it's going to negotiate with that television and start sending and streaming that media over to it. Pretty powerful. Something that would have been far more than a handful of lines in any other platform that we have put together.
It's absolutely
just a lot of these little gimmies that come along the way. Okay, so that's devices, which we'll talk about more. It's the Play 2 contract. And all right, so the last one here is settings. And again, the charms is working as a... The charms are working as a single point of invocation for the common tasks inside the operating system. The most common thing you would do inside any application, if not search, is going to be settings, preferences, options, personalization, something where you change some sort of configuration. And so how do you find that, Darren? You look under options, or you look under, say, tools, and then go to options, maybe edit, and then go to preferences, then maybe file, and then go to, and it's
I think what you're trying to say here is inconsistent.
It's inconsistent.
It's left up to the developer's decision, the designer's decision, where to place it in the more traditional apps.
Yeah, and this is very similar to the discussion around search. You know, how do you search an application? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just start typing, sometimes you have to click something, sometimes there's a box. What the idea is, there's going to be a consistency in these types of applications thanks to these charms. And so why are the charms there? The charms are really there, again, for the user, making it so the user has a consistent interaction with applications built around this framework. And so that is the settings charm. The settings charm allows you to register your about box, your settings options, whatever it is you might have.
Help. All manner of different things can come up there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And that's what it would look like. Okay, so
if only they were showing it.
One of the yeah, exactly. And so as you could tell, that slide that I just went past, that's probably the most important slide of the deck. I don't plan on going back to it. All right, yeah. So.
Thanks, Barry.
Shout out to Barry. Just oh, but this slide is good too. So the application tiles. Nah, that's true. If you, I have a Windows Phone, Darren.
I have a Windows Phone too.
This fact is right here. I'll just show you. This is my Windows Phone. My Windows Phone. One of the reasons I love my Windows Phone is because of the live tiles, the start screen. The reason I like it is not just the shape and all of that business, but because it keeps me out of all the applications. It's kind of call it glance and go. It's sort of our marketing term, but it really works too. I mean, you open up, you can see whether or not you have messages. You can even read a few of the messages or say instant messages you might have received.
Yeah, it's not a static display. It's constantly refreshing with information that's important to you.
That paradigm has been moved straight into Windows 8. So now when I go to the start menu, it's not the icon for the app that I want to run. Now it's the live tile for the app that I want to run. It shows both the logo, if that's what I want, as well as cycling through information that it's pushed out there. We often talk about the two things that live tiles can do. The first thing that a live tile can do is keep a user out of your app. And this is very valuable to the user. So,
which sometimes sounds a little bit counterintuitive. Don't go into the app.
Yeah, exactly. If the only way you monetize your app is through advertising, that really hurts, right?
Yes.
But it actually makes sense because, you know, if I were to open up my start screen today, I can't show everything. I've only got room for a few. And, you know, we're already in this cosmic battle with the uninstall button. Right? Mm-hmm. It's, really, we are, right? The reason we write excellent apps is because we don't want to be uninstalled. But we're also, there's this sub-battle that we want to be on their start menu and we want to be a place of where they can really see it. Building a live tile that is useful and valuable mm-hmm. is really the strategy to be able to get there.
Because it invites interaction in reality. Somebody looks there, they get a quick status review, but they see, I'm interested in understanding more about that. Click, engage, and then you've got that experience of somebody opening up your app and getting in.
That's right. Weather is probably the most perfect one, right? Where you can say, here's the temperature, which is the most likely thing that you're going to want from your app, so you don't have to go in. But then suddenly it turns red when there is a thunderstorm coming or some sort of warm.
Or you're living in Denver and it goes from 80 to 27 in a day.
We got to sunny Seattle just in time, didn't
we? Yeah. This is one of the rare times where the weather in Seattle is better than where we came from.
Yeah, this may be the time, actually.
Yeah. Let's think about that.
All right, very good. So tiles are special because they do act like a logo. I mean, do act like an icon for you to go into. You don't have to implement a live tile. You can create a crummy app, I think, is the takeaway from that.
Absolutely. Windows 8 cannot cure inherent crumminess of apps.
That's exactly right. If you do create a live tile, or if you don't create a live tile, which I guess we refer to that as a dead tile, a not live tile, then keep it square, keep it small. There's no reason to take up a lot of extra space.
Yeah.
With a tile, it's going to be the same from here to eternity. Mm-hmm. But an app that pushes data out, you can take up as much of the space that you want, either the square or the wide tile. And as well as queuing it. It doesn't have to be just one little block of content.
Yeah.
You can queue up to 5 different pieces of information.
And it can cycle through those. It's a very, very impressive facility.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, so one of the constraints, I hate to use the word constraint because it seems negative. So one of the restrictions.
One of the opportunities to embrace.
Yeah, so one of the things that developers have to remember when they're writing an application like this is that the operating system is going to listen to how quickly your application loads. You have 5 seconds to render UI onto the screen. If you don't render UI onto the screen, it'll assume that there's a failure and automatically close your application.
Because again, experience is king.
That's right. This is for the user. The user doesn't want to wait more than 5 minutes, 5 seconds, or 5 minutes.
Certainly not 5 minutes.
Yeah, there's a range between 5 seconds and 5 minutes. No, but seriously, so we show the splash screen. If the splash screen is stuck for more than 5 seconds, then you'll automatically get terminated. So we solved this.
Or at least your application will.
Yeah, yeah. You may not be.
Yeah.
You might be.
Developers should be, perhaps, but...
Yeah. you can easily address this. Sometimes you just have to load data from a web service. Sometimes you have to call out to some data store that you've got, parse a file or whatever. And it does take more than 5 seconds. You never know, the application or the machine that you're running on could just run slower. So you solve this with an extended splash screen that looks just like the initial splash screen, but you give feedback to the user at the same time. The importance is around these boundaries that the operating system gives. The splash screen is how we handle the startup time, but there's even shutdown time. Mm-hmm. There's memory footprint. There's a lot that developers can't just forget, can't just say, solve it with more RAM.
It's really a curated environment that you're running in. You know, the system is providing facilities, but it expects you to honor certain contracts of behavior, startup time and so on and so forth. And as you mentioned, we'll be talking about lifecycle management, but there are certain contracts of behavior that are expected there as well. So we'll be going into that in some detail.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the navigation inside your application and how we can deal with that. So the first is around the top app bar. So let's say it's a slate, and so the top app bar comes down. Now, it used to be that we would give direction or some sort of guidance to developers, and we would release Office, and then we would just copy Office, right? That would be the only direction we would really give. And so that's the reason we release the ribbon, right? And the next thing you know, we start seeing the ribbon everywhere. And so you might naturally ask, where's the ribbon in these applications? And there is no ribbon, right? The ribbon doesn't fit in this paradigm. So we have instead app bars that are at the top and the bottom. The top app bar is for navigation inside your application, moving between view to view. But we also have a bottom app bar, and the bottom app bar is for commanding. And this is where you would put the interaction with your application directly. So if they need to do whatever it is, they would show up here. And we look how that we've kind of grouped them from left to right. And the idea is, again, that's closer to your thumbs. But also there's a logic to it as well, where tasks on the right are global tasks or global commands, and then commands on the left are specific commands to whatever the user is doing at that moment. So there is some logic around it. Of course, there are full guidelines to it as well. But these are things to start to consider. How many commands can I fit? You can fit about, honestly, about 10 or 11 comfortably. Where do they belong? Which one? Do I need a submenu? Do I need to navigate with the top menu? Again, things for developers to think about. You can use flyouts as well. This is so you don't have to navigate away from the page in order to interact with the user. A flyout allows them to type in more information, say, or show subcommands inside the command that they may have selected.
So again, these areas are things that you really need to think about when you're designing your application. You know, it's not a case of just diving straight in and then overloading one screen with all these interactions. Start thinking about your navigation, your progression through your app, so that each screen is really presenting a logical grouping of tasks, which should be a subset of the overall feature of your app.
Yeah, that's right. Developers are tempted to put more in than they really need, right? Mm-hmm. More often than not, if you have 100 functions or features inside your application, 10 of them are used by the users.
Yeah, I mean, think how many desktop applications are just built around this idea of a grid that shows everything. We're covered with buttons and commands that you can do every feature. It saves you writing multiple screens, which may be great for the developer, but not necessarily great for the user.
Right.
Windows 8 is really focusing on creating more task-oriented interactions that are simpler in its initial presentation, but still allows you the exploration to actually do a number of different processes.
Yeah. So we have these flyouts that allow us to extend the command bar and interact with the user. Another way to interact with the user then would also be through toast notifications. Toast notifications are they're a transient way of communicating, right? Mm-hmm. They show up, but then they go away. And I think it's important to point out as well, and let's see, can I pull this up on my screen? I sure can. That notifications can be turned on and they can be turned off by the user, and you can't control that. So if those notifications are suddenly a very important part of your application, you might be in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great point. The user is in control. You have to accept that and be aware of the platform capabilities, such as if you use location services. The user can turn around and say, I am disabling location services for this application. If you're expecting always to be able to interact with them and you're going to cap a critical fault if that feature is not available, your app isn't going to work in the App Store.
Right. So these are the features you need to know that you can leverage to make your app better, but they can't be critical to your application. I think that's really the takeaway. Toast notifications, just like tiles, they use templates that developers leverage so that they all have a consistency around them. You can also cause them from your application to say that some process is finished. You can also call it from the background. You can also send them from the web. And so there's a lot of neat stuff there as well. And
But you can't guarantee that the user is going to see them.
No, you can't guarantee it. Yeah, if they miss it, it's gone. If it's disabled, it doesn't queue up.
Yep.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I said push notifications, but I think it's at least worthwhile to talk about push notifications. So we refer to this as, what do we call this? WNS, the Windows Notification Services.
Exactly.
It's a free service to developers that they can use as a tunnel to send to a user and all the devices that user may have your application installed on. A lot of power there, but it is a black box, and it is kind of a black hole as well. Once you send it off, you don't get a receipt back.
Yep, you don't get notification whether it's been received or not, nor is there any express guarantee that that message will be delivered.
Yeah, I mean, how could you? I mean, the computer's off and maybe never turned on again.
Yeah, right? It's not going to hold it in perpetuity to deliver it.
Yeah, exactly. Push notifications are a powerful way for me to have most of the logic on the server and then the server to be able to interact with it so I don't have to worry about it. Because when we talk about background tasks, we'll see that they aren't very powerful, right? You can only do so many things.
Yeah, it's not the same as a Windows service. So that's an important thing to realize.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it. So a background task is limited to only a single CPU second every 2 hours. That is very, very small. I mean, that doesn't equate to a clock second, so it is a little bit more than just a second of operation.
Yep.
But at the same time, you have to be very discerning in what you want to accomplish in the background task. What's nice about a background task versus push notifications is you can run offline. You don't have to have an internet connection necessarily to do it. So you can, and you can use it to check things, you can use it to update your tile, just like push notifications can update your tile.
And of course, that's there again for the user experience in terms of ensuring that you have decent battery life. If you had a plethora of background tasks that were there chewing up processing cycles, then your battery life is going to be reduced. So
there are other platforms that allow background tasks to do whatever for as long as, right?
Yeah.
And they suffer. They really do, especially from the a battery point of view. So we also, I want to talk about other things in your application. So your application can be started by file activation. And we'll talk about this more when we get to, we have a module just on this, not just file activation, but others. And file activation is special because file activation lets you associate a, let's say, you know, .pdf is the file extension for Adobe Reader.
Yep.
And when I double click a .pdf, it launches the Adobe Reader. If .xyz was the file association for your app, say Darren, then it would be .darren, .211.
Yeah, that's it. Ha ha.
Then you know, that would activate your application. I think one important thing is you cannot lock the association to be just your application either, though. If you, let's say I wanted to write my .211 app, I could.
Exactly.
I could put it in the store, and now the user chooses between, and I can't force the
it's
user.
It's not last in wins. It's not how in Windows where you could completely override the registration for different file types. Instead, you register your interest in that file type, and the user is empowered to select which one is going to open it.
Yeah, and honestly, .211 doesn't make much sense as like .jpeg, where you might make an application that manipulates images or does something like that, and you do want to make your app one of the options that the user sees,
Absolutely.
Not just, you know, their viewer or whatever they see. If I were a developer, another thing I get to think about around files is not just that it gets to activate, but I also get to go out and use the file system. Mm-hmm. And so now we get to talk about the sandbox again, and that is developers don't get to reach out to the hard drive. Like if I were to write a desktop app, I just type in the path and go get it, right? And this is a bad deal for the user. If I install an app and I don't want it to go get, say, my Quicken files, I can't stop it, right? It just goes and gets it. But that's different in Windows 8 apps, right? These store apps allow me to give permission first so that I install an app and I don't want it to go get the Quicken apps, let's say, they can't, right? Because I never gave them permission.
And as developers, we need to declare our interest in certain folders and so on and so forth, that the application wants to interact with these things, so the user gets the ability to approve or deny that on startup.
And so there are going to be these instances where I do need to interact with some sort of file, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't just have a standalone app all the time. And so that's why we have file pickers. And so file picker, there are native, and then there are custom file pickers that work as extensions. And what that is it allows me to, first it allows me to pop up, it's kind of like the open dialog that we've used for in.NET forever, that allows the user to select a file or a folder. But it also allows me to create an extension picker. And so SkyDrive is a perfect example where I have an extension picker. The user goes in and they go to pick something from their hard drive, they drop down, and there's my option. Let's say I wrote SkyDrive. I select SkyDrive, I interact with my SkyDrive folders as if they're local, and all of the interaction and authentication and everything else that has to be done is handled inside my extension. The user doesn't see that. In applications that use me as a picker, they don't see it either. And so I can really extend applications, extend the operating system.
Whilst maintaining that consistent experience, which is...
That's right, and leverage it as well. I may not even know how to access SkyDrive, but I can leverage the SkyDrive picker.
Exactly.
Yeah, a lot of power in file pickers. So there is a way to reach out to the hard drive. I think developers need to just know you can't do it willy-nilly. You certainly can't do it without declaring it.
Yeah.
No getting around. Now, when I save data, I can save to the hard drive if they give me permission, but they may not. But that's okay. I still have isolated storage, which is very similar to .NET development. And so I have a local folder that I can store to. I also have a temporary folder that will be recycled when the user restarts Windows. But I also have a roaming folder. And roaming is a cool, powerful, built-in API to Windows 8 that allows me to have both settings and files. I can interact with this folder as if it's a local folder, but it's actually a automatically roamed by Windows 8 up into a magical place in the cloud, which is really your SkyDrive, and then across all the different devices.
Which is incredible. You know, just at the general operating system level, you know, you can specify backgrounds, colors, themes, and so on and so forth. You set it on one device, it will roam across, and your other device will inherit those settings. It's very, very neat.
Yeah, and you can't really control it. And what I mean is the developer can't control it. They say, please roam this, and you let Windows go from there, because Windows is looking at available bandwidth. Windows is looking at whether or not this is a metered connection. Windows is looking at all kinds of things that are going on, all the other things that are being roamed as well, and whether or not they're batched together, and all kinds of things. So there's a heuristic that is really out of the control of the developer, but it does allow you to leverage it. It's very quick. I mean, it kind of depends on what's going on with the system and how you're connected, but roaming is really a neat way to make sure that your settings and files kind of roam. You can't roam everything. Can't roam more than 100K. Right, and so there's more around that than we're probably giving credit to right now, but something that developers shouldn't look past, because it is free, and it is built in, and there's no reason not to leverage it, I think.
Rude not to.
It'd be rude not to. This is my favorite slide.
Yeah.
Over and over, you've been talking about all these registering capabilities, right? And so every application that we have, that we submit to the store, must have an AppX manifest.
Yep.
It's a simple XML file, but what it really is a way of communicating first to the store what we're trying to accomplish to make sure that the type of account we have allows us to do that. But then it communicates back from the store to the user as they're installing your application to say, okay, they want to use your webcam, is that okay? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, they want to use your location, is that okay? Yes. Okay, they want to use your hard drive, is that okay? Yes. And there's a list of capabilities that are enumerated inside the app manifest.
So it's no longer really a case of buyer beware. It's we've declared to the buyer exactly what it is that they need. And you can also see those requested features in the Windows Store before you even download and install the app.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, let me ask you this. How do you prevent the user from saying yes, 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 right, without reading? You can't. All
you
right,
can't.
We can't solve everything,
You cannot
right?
solve everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what if I'm writing an application that uses location? And let's say location is important to my app. What was that?
I have no idea.
And oh, yeah, that's funny. Dang it. All right.
Moving swiftly on.
What was that? Yes.
Yes.
So let's say I'm writing an application that uses location. It's important to me, and so I accept it as, or I put it in as a capability, right? What do I need to think about now as a developer? So I know that the user is going to be prompted. They might prompt, they may say yes, they may say no. But then there's a third option. They may not have the capability I'm asking for. A webcam is a better example.
Absolutely.
I may ask for the webcam. They may not have a webcam.
So, I mean, really what we're talking about is building robust code, building a robust experience, downgrading your experience gracefully based upon the capabilities that are available. You can also detect to see whether the services are there in terms of the capabilities and so on. And as Jerry mentioned earlier on, if you're building an application where a certain facility is essential, then you need to communicate that to the user in a clear, non-threatening way should they disable it. Turn around and say, hey, you know, this feature can only be leveraged if this service is enabled.
Yeah. Your application may require the internet. That's something that has to be approved. And if the user doesn't have an internet connection, which that's a very common scenario too, right? You have to be able to respond. You have to code defensively.
Exactly. You know, it's no good having the application just flash up and flash down because it effectively crashes. You need to turn around and say, in a disconnected state. Now, when you're designing your application, some of these features such as internet connectivity, we can't always guarantee it's going to be available. As Jerry mentioned, sometimes you might be on a metered connection. And so by default, the operating system was going to suggest that you're not leveraging a feature because you are on a metered capability.
Right.
And the user might quite smartly might turn around and say, no, I'm not going to leverage it. Think about a local caching strategy. Think about what data can I have locally that gives the user some form of experience, perhaps the last interaction they did, and so on and so forth, so that it's not a wasted effort for them to move into the application.
Let's make sure we have a module later that we talk about this in depth.
Okay, I'm thinking about one.
Done. Glad we prepared it. All right, great. Okay, so we're a little ahead of schedule. The next module is a little long.
You've got design language.
I love that. Okay, the next is a little long, and so is this one. Okay, hold on. Darn that slide for looking like it was the last one. Okay, so let's talk about that very quickly, even though it's probably the most important. We're going to go a little over. I can feel it already.
Start as you mean to go.
Windows design language. Let's do talk about the Windows design language.
Yes.
The Windows design language for Windows 8 is the guideline for developers on how their application should look and how it should interact with the with users. So, earlier I was saying we release Office and everybody copies it, but we never really gave solid guidance to developers on how their application should look and interact. So now that is the design language. It is prescriptive, it is exact, and it is optional. I think that's an important takeaway, is that it is very specific on what you should do. And if you don't have a reason not to follow it, you should. If you do have a reason not to follow it, your application is more important than the guideline. And so if you're like, oh, I really need for the button to do this and be here, but I know that the design guideline says not to, you win, right? But just have a good reason for it. Okay, let's talk about it in general. The design language itself is a very minimalistic design. It's the removal of distractions. It's the removal of serifs. I mean, everything else, right? Mm-hmm. The Bauhaus School of Design is one of the influences of it, as well as just simplicity, right?
Yeah.
It really is. And it's just removing the things that you don't need. And as it turns out, you don't need very much. You really don't, in order to, and still deliver an excellent experience to.
It's a reaction to those kind of really cluttered, overly chromed interfaces where everyone spends an awful lot of time creating all this cruft that actually takes attention away from the content.
Yeah, no, you're right. So let's go through the five core principles. And it's nice because the guidelines are so broad, but it is nice to kind of bring them up to at a higher level. All right, so here are the five core principles. And the first one is do more with less. And that's really what we were just saying, this idea of minimalism and removing. It's funny how great a user experience you can create with less functionality inside your application. And that's just the reality of it. The second one is this idea of pride of craftsmanship, where our goal, Darren, is not just to knock it out and ship it. Our goal really is to create an experience for the user that is excellent. And so this is the idea of pride and craftsmanship, not only that your app looks good, but really that you have taken the time to refine it in every scenario, every use case that the user is going through, and you haven't ignored the ones that you're least interested in, let's say.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you see this in a lot of different types of applications, and this is really an encouragement to do a better job. I mean, mm-hmm. That's really what it is. The next one is around fast and fluid. Now, we have, of course, limitations around we don't know what hardware this will necessarily be written on, and so how fast can it be? The reality is it can be as fast as you make it. So we can leverage GPU acceleration. We can leverage better code. We can leverage the libraries that come inside the framework now as well. And so be fast and fluid is use animations so that the user, that's the kind of the fluid feel, use animations so that the user feels like they're part of your application, but also be fast. Don't overdo it. Certainly don't overwhelm them with crazy animations. How many times, Darren, have you gone to like a Flash site and you hate it because it's beautiful, but then it takes 10 minutes to every click you make because there's a million animations around
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, and depending upon, I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's not available on a lot of the constrained resource devices, is they take a lot of system resources to actually run those, and the experience isn't the same on your desktop and on those resource-constrained devices.
No, you're right. They took a good idea and just went too far. And not all sites. I don't mean that. There are many Flash sites that are great, but some of them just drive you nuts. And usually when you see one, you know it's all Flash, you just figure it's going to be bad. That's because it just there was this habit of overusing. It's like candy. You couldn't developers couldn't stop eating it. The other one is around authentically digital. So this is, you know, this whole idea around skeuomorphism and physical affordance and all these things that there's so many discussions on it right now. But the idea is this is a pixel-based computer, and there's no reason your app can't be pixel-based as well. It's not necessary, let's say, for it to have a leather background. It's not important that when you write a note that it be on note paper. There are those aspects as well as the colors. You know, there are colors in the real world. We have muted tones and natural tones, and we have crazy tones we can do in the digital world. Why not take advantage of those to make it more of a digital experience? After all, we're inside a computer. There's no reason not to. We also talked about sharing, and that's the idea of win is one. We have a large ecosystem of applications. It's only growing, and there's no reason that using the share contract, let's say, we can't do more, right, because of it. Also, There is this idea of extensions that we talked about with file pickers, and you can do more as well. So this win as one is really bringing it together so that your application leverages others in the ecosystem, but probably more important in the design language is that your application looks like other apps in the system. It is important that you be differentiated, Darren. It is important that you have an application that is distinct and drives value that is specific for yours.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we call that, that differentiation is good, but we also have this idea of visual alignment, where I go into my application, I go into your application, they're completely different, but they're both similar. The user
isn't thrown off. There's a consistent vocabulary, and I think that's one of the key things that the design language gives you, is that consistent approach, so it's not a completely alien experience when you open up the app.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. Alien, exactly. So this slide is a fantastic slide. This slide really shows the full screen app, right? It's just the sunset, I realize, but it really drives it home. If your app is not about your app, your app is about the content that you're delivering. So if my app, let's say, was delivering pictures of sunsets, this is what I want to see in a sunset.
Yeah.
I don't want to see a bunch of chrome around it. I don't want to see a border. I don't want to see a button. I want to see the sunset, and then I want to have a mechanism to interact with it. And that's a real driver, this full screen. Content is king. That is a real driver to our language. And then you can pull in the information if you want to.
Yeah.
But you want to be able to immerse the user into the content.
Content is
app.
King.
That's exactly right. So this is a classic application. And it's not a classic. This is the classic demo. Yeah, it's classic because it's one of the first written.
Yeah, that just means it's old.
What's important here is, so see where the headline is. I'm going to do this little selection. We call this the silhouette, the window silhouette. And it kind of is the placement. You can see where the left border or the left margin is. You can see where the top and bottom margin are. You can see where the headline lines up. And all
that looks
those
like
are
that
important.
Should be consistent.
It is. This is really the beginning of this win as one idea. In fact, look at this. Here are four applications, and they're all completely different, right? Each one has their
own
interface.
You can't do that in Windows 8, though, can you?
Right. This is a slide. But the idea is you want to see them side by side like this so that you can see that they really are unique, and we haven't said to the developer, make an app full of boxes, right? That is not what the Windows design guideline says at all. What it really says is, now that you have it, look at this. I can lay the silhouette over it again, and they're all aligned. So I have this visual alignment so the user isn't lost when they go from app to app, but it also gives the developer and designer freedom to have a lot of flexibility in the design of their app.
The other nice thing is it gives the content room to breathe, that you're not just trying to cram everything in using micro fonts to get more things on the screen. It's all about presentation. It's all about readability.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It's actually perfect, right?
It's almost foreshadowing.
We have a whole scale of fonts, and fonts we've even written for these types of applications. The SCO UI is what we use, and this is the ramp that we go down as far as sizes, and it's important because we want your header to be resemblant of the header of all of the others, right? So how much do you get to vary from it? As much as you need to. But if you don't have a reason to vary from it, follow the ramp, follow the colors, follow the guidelines, follow the silhouette. All of those pieces are there for you. Ah, perfect. So we also have this idea of scaling. And so there's two things to think about. And the first one is the change in resolution, and the other one is the change in size. So these surfaces that we have right here are pretty nice, but they're a 10-inch device, 10-something, 0.1.
10.4,
something like that. But then we have these cool Heliums, I think they are. So this is a 27-inch device. As I move my app from here to here, you can see on the slide, this is what we want to happen. What we don't want is on the left. We don't want it to have all of this open space, and so we'll naturally scale it to fit the size that it is. This is a game where you have a certain number of rows and columns. If you write in a game, obviously you don't want to add more rows and columns to fill that space. You want to scale it so that it fits right. But you might have an application where you have content that just repeats, and then you can start thinking, how can I repeat so it flows down if it's in a larger device? Again, we have the simulator, and the simulator will simulate all sizes of devices, so you can kind of test these out and see.
Yeah, not only sizes, but also dot pitch.
That's right. In fact, I think that's probably, do I have it? Here we are. That's exactly right. So what if you go from the same size device, let's say your Surface back here and my Surface, and one is resolution one and the other one's double, right?
Yeah.
What happens if the user goes in and they say, I'm going to create a 50x50 button for the user to tap? Now, that's the smallest touch target that we recommend that you create. Now, if I go to a higher resolution, that'll suddenly be tiny, right, Darren?
If it's pixel-based, yes.
If it's pixel-based.
But fortunately, our devices and this infrastructure that we're operating within will actually scale that for us and make that larger.
That's right. Windows Store applications are fully resolution independent. I think that's very important. You don't have to sniff for it. You don't have to respond to it. It just makes your apps look better. They just get more crisp. But they don't look more crisp if you're using crappy images.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the key things is to understand that any of the vector-based rendering, such as all the bitmaps, such as any of the graphics layout, it's not a case of just it draws it small and then blows it up and gets all pixelated and blurry. It will render up and it will take advantage of the resolution to create much crisper presentation. However, if you give it a small image, the only thing it can do is stretch that image, which would suck unless we had a way of dealing with it.
Yeah, fortunately, it fixes it, right? All right, so absolutely. You can supply different scales of images so that at a low resolution device doesn't have to bring into memory a really large image, and those really high res monitors can really look great because they'll automatically go get these scaled images. You can do it through naming conventions, and then the platform handles the rest for you.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's really nice.
I want to build apps.
What's that?
I want to build apps.
Let's do it now. Let's stop this whole thing.
Yeah, let's go.
So we also have semantic zoom. And you know what? I'm going to skip this because we'll cover
this
in more detail.
We're going to cover this in detail.
And I realize we're just a hair over and I don't want to miss this long 8-point slide. All right. So let me go through them quickly because these are the 8 things of a Windows 8 application. And so we'll just nail them here. All right. So the first one is what we just talked about. And that's the Windows language, right? Follow the Windows language. And that, you can even see that on down at 8. Follow those first 5 principles that we talked about. Make it fast and fluid. Don't forget that you have to snap, and we'll talk about snapping. Don't forget the contracts. Those are the charms over on the side. Use those and leverage those. Don't ignore it. Invest in a great tile. We talked about the different things that tiles will do. And definitely make it so that if you are connected to the internet, you can kind of run it. That's what you want. Okay, that's what you want to make it so that when the user is in your application, it doesn't feel stale. When the user is connected to the internet, it leverages it and uses it. And again, we've talked about this before, but also roam to the cloud. And really, that you could expand that to say, leverage all these APIs that are native inside Windows 8. Leverage all these APIs that are free to developers just to use to make your application better. There's a lot here. The guidelines itself are on MSDN, and they are very long, right? If you were dedicated to building a good application, then you need to spend a few hours to browse through these guidelines. Design.windows.com is where it all begins. Go through the different guides. I mean, literally every control. Where do I use a progress bar? Where do I use a slide? How do the buttons work? How do I handle error messages? All these pieces are no longer left up to the I wonders. Now they all have specific answers.
And one of the top tips you shared yesterday was searching for, recommendations? What was it? Key recommendations. If you make sure you're using those guidelines
as
a keyword search, then you'll hone in to these summaries that really go in and tell you how to exploit these various capabilities in your app.
Yeah, so if you're using Bing or Google or whatever, and you want to find out about the search charm, you say search charm guidelines, and it'll take you to those
key recommendations, which is very useful.
It really does. Okay, Darren, let's take a 10-minute break here. We're actually doing great. I mean, this is great. We're still
We're only a few hours over.
Yeah. And Barry, great job so far.
Woo-hoo.
All right, great. And we'll see you guys in 10 minutes.